Almost 1,400 years ago, the ancient and prosperous lands of the Middle East were on the verge of a conflict of three empires and three religions, two of them fighting a constant, bloody and fruitless war for centuries, one a newcomer looking to make its mark. The newcomer was the Rashidun Caliphate, and its arrival would change the history of the region and the world forever. The Roman state was almost constantly at war with the Iranian empires ever since the two entities touched borders in the 60s BC, as the Parthian Empire achieved a famous victory at Carrhae. The Roman Republic transitioned into the empire, and then this empire's western portion was lost to foreign invasions, leaving only the Eastern Roman Empire, while the Parthian Empire was replaced by the Sassanid Empire. But even then, these two states continued to fight. In the 3rd century AD, another factor was introduced to these conflicts, the Ghassanids and the Lakhmids. These two Arab tribal confederations migrated from modern Yemen and became the vassal states of the Eastern Roman Empire and the Sassanids respectively. They participated in the Roman-Sassanid wars, often as scouts or raiders detached from the armies, or as light cavalry units within the armies, while also defending both empires from the Arab tribal raids from the south. The populations of these kingdoms worshipped traditional Arab paganism and Monophysite Christianity, and the latter created tensions with their suzerains, as the Sassanids were sure that any Christian influence may strengthen their Roman enemies, while the Romans adhered to Miaphysite Orthodox Christianity, which considered Monophysitism to be heretical. The Roman attempts to suppress Monophysitism caused the Ghassanids to rebel against them in the late 6th to early 7th century and weakened Roman support in the area. On the other hand, religious tensions between the Lakhmids and the Sassanids were compounded by the attempts of Shah Khosrow II to control the region directly. In 602, he captured and executed the Lakhmid king, Alnuman III, turning the kingdom into a province administered by a governor. That forced the Lakhmid tribes to ask their Arab brethren to the south for help. Although the allied forces managed to defeat the Sassanid army at Dikar in 609, the Sassanids were able to keep the province under their rule. This sequence of events not only created divided loyalties among the Arab tribes in the region, but effectively stripped the Sassanid border of its traditional buffer. Despite that, the Sassanids were still very strong. In 602, they used the internal strife within the Eastern Roman Empire as a pretext to declare war. The Sassanids scored a number of impressive victories in the first years of the war, and although the Roman noble Heraclius took the throne in 611 and started to stabilize the situation, he wasn't able to slow down the enemy completely. By 621, the Sassanids controlled the South Caucasus, the Levant, Egypt, and most of Anatolia, which marked the largest extent of their territory. Even though Emperor Heraclius was forced to fight against the Avars in Europe too, he was able to gain some momentum by winning two battles against the Sassanids between 622 and 625. According to some sources, Khosrow enlisted all men capable of fighting and turned the tide again. In 626, an army under Shah Baraz besieged the capital of the empire, Constantinople, supported by the Avars and Sklaveni from Europe. The Roman Empire was on the brink of destruction, but the defenders of the capital persevered. This was the turning point in the war, as in 627, Heraclius entered an alliance with the leader of the Western Turkic Khaganate, Tongyebku, and together they invaded the Iranian heartland. Heraclius defeated the Sassanids at Nineveh in 627, and threatened the capital, Ctesiphon, in 628, which prompted the nobles to overthrow Khosrow. His son, Kavad II, became the next Shah, and signed a peace treaty with Heraclius. The Sassanids paid a war indemnity, but otherwise the conflict achieved nothing, and the two exhausted empires returned to the pre-war borders. Meanwhile, to the south, the Arabian Peninsula was going through an upheaval. The population of this peninsula worshipped many religions, from the traditional Arab pagan beliefs to Zoroastrianism, Judaism, and Christianity. The Sassanids controlled the province of Mazun and the eastern portion of Yemen, while the deserts in the central and northern parts of the region were ruled by nomadic Bedouin Arabs. Their brethren resided in the rich merchant city-states in Hejaz. One of these city-states, called Mecca, was both a religious and economic center governed by the Quraysh tribe, trading mostly spices with Aksum, the Romans, and the Sassanids. In 570, a boy called Muhammad was born in the Quraysh tribe. As a young man, Muhammad spent his time as a merchant, probably participating in and then leading trade caravans all over the region. As is often the case with traders, Muhammad would meet and converse with members of various religions on his travels. According to the later sources, he started receiving divine revelations sometime in 610. Soon this new prophet began spreading the message of a new religion, Islam, in his home city of Mecca. However, the Meccans didn't receive it well, and in 614 they started to persecute adherents of Islam. All this prompted Muhammad and his followers, the Muslims, to emigrate to Medina in 622. This started a war between the Muslims and Mecca, and by 629 the latter lost and was conquered. According to the early Muslim sources, at this point, sometime in 628, Muhammad sent envoys to the neighboring states, urging their leaders to join Islam and bow to the one God, Allah. The Sassanid Shah Khosrow II insulted the Muslim envoy, while the one sent to the Romans was killed in Ghassanid territory. This prompted an attack by a small Muslim army, which was defeated by the Ghassanids and Romans in September of 629 at Mutah. The same sources claim that Muhammad decided to lead a 30,000-strong army into the Byzantines' territory to retaliate, and took the city of Tabuk. However, most modern sources do not agree with this account of events. In any case, the conquests of Muhammad in Arabia continued. By 631, most of the Arabian Peninsula was under Muslim control. Muhammad passed away a year later. There are conflicting sources regarding the succession process, but one of the closest allies of Muhammad, Abu Bakr, became his successor with the title of Caliph. He was the first of the Rashidun Caliphs. In the meantime, Qavad II, who became the Sassanid Shah in February of 628, immediately started killing his brothers to secure the throne, which resulted in deepening disagreements between the Persian and Parthian nobles. Qavad died of plague in September, and although his 8-year-old son became the next Shah as Ardashir III, the empire was controlled by a member of the Parthian clique, the vizier Ma'adar Jushnas. This deeply concerned the Persian party, so it allied with Khosrow's general Shahbaraz. The latter attacked and took the capital in April of 630, killing Ardashir and Ma'adar Jushnas and becoming the Shah. The Sassanid realm was now in a state of civil war. Using all that, the governors of Yemen and Mazun declared their independence from Ctesiphon, which made them easy prey for the rising caliphate. Just 40 days after Shahbaraz took the throne, he was killed and the leader of the Parthian faction, Faruk Hormizd, raised Khosrow's daughter Boran to the throne. This first queen in Sassanid history was overthrown by the son of Shahbaraz, Shapur, a few months later. To stop the war between the factions, Faruk offered a marriage between Shapur and another daughter of Khosrow, Azarmidokht, but the latter refused and the noble usurped the throne for himself in late 630. He would be killed by the supporters of Azarmidokht in 631, after which she took the throne for herself. Faruk's son Rostam marched his troops to Ctesiphon to avenge his father, defeating Azarmidokht's armies along the way. After taking the capital, he restored Boran as the queen. The ruling alliance of Boran and Rostam managed to convince the leader of the Persian clique, Pyrrhus, to stop the hostilities. However, after Rostam left the capital for the frontier, Firuzan killed Boran in June of 632. Rostam then marched for the capital again. According to some sources, the armies of both Firuzan and Rostam were tired of the bloodshed and forced their generals to reach an accord. One of the last members of the House of Sasan, the 8-year-old grandson of Khosrow II, was crowned as Yazdegerd III. Although the civil war was now over, the Sassanid realm was extremely vulnerable, as the Parthian clique basically controlled the northeastern portion of the empire, while Turkic raiders attacked from the Caucasus and Central Asia. At the same time, the first caliph Abu Bakr sent a portion of his army under Usaba ibn Zayd to raid the Ghassanids in June of 632, possibly checking if the Byzantine frontier was well defended. The death of Muhammad and the departure of his army made a big number of newly conquered Arab territories think that the caliphate was fragile, and in July, all of the peninsula save for Hejaz rebelled against Abu Bakr in what was called the Ridda War, or the War of Apostasy, as many rebel groups were led by people who declared themselves prophets. The situation was most dire around Medina, as the rebels threatened the second most important city of the new realm in late July. However, Abu Bakr swiftly marched to the area and defeated the rebels in early August. That gave enough time for the army, which was sent north and defeated a small Ghassanid army around Muta, to return. Abu Bakr proved to be a talented commander. Instead of uniting his armies and marching on each of the rebel groups separately, which would have allowed the rebels to attack his rear with impunity, he divided his army into smaller groups, and these units attacked the enemies around the peninsula. This strategy worked to perfection, and by March of 633, the caliph's rule over the entire region was restored. It is difficult to assess how much the caliphate lost in terms of manpower, but the sources underline that the generals and troops gained invaluable experience in this conflict. While the Ridda Wars were going on, the leader of the Arab Bani Bakr tribe, Muthanna bin Haritha, was raiding the Sassanid territories in southern Iraq. The Sassanid civil wars made this frontier subject to attacks, and Muthanna, who adopted Islam sometime in the 630s, informed Abu Bakr of this fact in early 633. The caliph decided that it was a good time to take over Iraq, and one of his main generals during the Ridda Wars, Khalid ibn al-Walid, was ordered to invade the region. Khalid was able to recruit an army of 18,000 at his base at Yamama and left for Iraq in late March 633. A letter was sent to the Sassanid governor of Dast Maysan, Ormazd, demanding his surrender. Ormazd obviously didn't, but sent a letter to the capital, asking Shah Yazdegerd III for reinforcements. This letter was probably a trick by Khalid, as Hormazd gathered his 20,000 and marched out of the capital of his governorship, Ubala, to defend the crucial road from Yamama near Kazima. Khalid, however, moved his troops through the desert and threatened Hufir. The Sassanid leader was informed of this and had to march towards Hufir via Ubala. According to the Muslim sources, that was exactly what Khalid was hoping would happen. Despite the civil wars, Sassanid armies were still stronger, as their armor and weaponry made them superior, and the only tangible advantage the caliph's forces had was their mobility. Khalid was going to use this mobility to tire the Sassanid army. This would become one of the most important elements of the early Muslim expansion. Their mobility and aggression were forcing their foe to defend multiple cities and fortresses, as it was never clear where the Arabs would strike. By the time Hormazd reached Hufair, Khalid started marching to Kazima. He could have probably taken the city with ease, but didn't want to be besieged by the heavily armored Sassanids, so his troops waited and rested to the south of Kazima, while Hormazd marched towards him. In the first days of April, the tired Sassanid forces approached. The engagement that would occur in the area is traditionally known as the Battle of the Chains, due to the description of the Sassanid forces in the Muslim sources. According to them, the Sassanid infantrymen were chained to each other to create a cohesive line, or to prevent any retreat. However, this makes no sense tactically, as that would have made the infantry even less mobile, and each dead warrior would have burdened their companions. We also never see this description in the numerous battles fought between the Romans and the Sassanids. Most probably, this stems from an incorrect reading of the Persian word silsila, which can be translated as a mountain chain, a bounding chain, or a single line of soldiers. So the word chain might be a metaphor for the disciplined Sassanid infantry. In any case, Khalid wasn't going to allow Hormozd's troops to rest, and his preparations forced the Sassanids to form up directly to the west of Kazima at the end of the tiring march. Their formation was the traditional infantry center and cavalry wings. Meanwhile, Khalid's army was arranged in a similar manner, but for the time being stayed in the desert behind the hills dividing the two armies. This delay only added to the fatigue among the Sassanids, as they had to stay in formation in their full panoply under the sun. However, this waiting couldn't continue for long, as the Sassanids controlled the springs in the area, so a few hours later, Khalid emerged on the hills and his troops stopped some distance away from those of Hormozd. The only surviving primary sources of this engagement belong to the Muslim historians, so we will present their view of this battle. As was customary for the region, and traditional for the Roman, Sassanid, and Arab battles of the era, the battle started with a duel, as Hormozd moved forward and called Khalid to fight him one-on-one. Apparently, Hormozd then dismounted and Khalid followed suit. As the two generals clashed and fought to a standstill, a few Sassanid-skilled warriors attacked Khalid. Another Arab general, Kaka bin Amr, who will play a larger role in the future, saw this and also decided to join the fray, attacking Khalid's assailants. Kaka and Khalid were able to overcome the Sassanid fighters and killed Hormozd. The Arab generals returned to their lines and Khalid ordered his troops forward. The armies engaged each other. On the wings, the balance of forces didn't allow either side to gain the upper hand, while in the center, the Muslim infantry charged their counterparts a few times, clashing and falling back without dealing much damage. However, the Muslim troops were much more rested, as even the infantrymen had traveled to the battle mounted. The Sassanid footmen weren't able to rest after their march, and each charge tired them even more. During one of the charges, Khalid's center managed to crack the disciplined Sassanid line in a few places. The Sassanid army, which was left leaderless in the wake of the duel, panicked, and the commanders leading the wings, Qubaz and Anushjan, started retreating with their horsemen. Their Muslim cavalry counterparts didn't chase the enemy horsemen, and instead enveloped the Sassanid center. Soon, the battle was over. We don't have a clear source on the number of casualties, but it is probably fair to assume that half of the Sassanid army was lost, while Khalid's casualties were less than a few thousand. Meanwhile, Shah Yaztagird, who received Hormozd's letter in late March, decided to send an army under Karinz to reinforce his governor. The speed at which it happened suggests that only the forces around the capital were gathered. According to the sources, Karinz had somewhere between 15 and 25,000 men when he moved south and crossed the Tigris. He was apparently moving towards Uballa to help the governor, but after he crossed the small river named Makil, he encountered the rest of Hormozd's army, led by Qubaz and Anushjan, some 10,000 troops. Karinz was told about the events of the Battle of the Chains. Simultaneously, a mobile force commanded by Muthanna appeared nearby, probably sent by Khalid to chase the remainder of the Sassanid force and scout ahead, while he was recruiting from the ranks of the Arab tribes in the area of Kazima and Hufair. We don't know what Karinz was thinking at this point, but it is clear that the Sassanids understood that they were not dealing with a minor raid, and they faced a traditional Bedouin Arab army made up of light cavalry. Catching Muthanna's mobile force in the open field would be impossible, since the Shah's army was considerably slower, so Karinz didn't move to the strategically crucial Uballa to protect it, likely worried that Muthanna would be able to attack his flank and rear. The Sassanid general decided to sacrifice Uballa and keep his position along the river in order to prevent Khalid from crossing the Tigris, and also from marching westwards to the most important city of the region, Al-Hira. In the meantime, Khalid was informed by Muthanna that a new army was moving to the south. The Sassanid position left him no other way to advance. Using the whole army to take Uballa might have entrapped him, so only a small group was sent to take it, while Khalid went on and united with Muthanna. The battle that is now known as the Battle of the River took place in the third week of April. The Sassanids had anywhere from 25 to 50,000 troops, depending on the sources, while Khalid commanded around 18,000, as he was able to reinforce his army by recruiting from the local Arab tribes. The sources for this battle are conflicted, so we will try to do our best to form a coherent narrative. Before the armies formed up in the morning, Khalid personally scouted the positions of Karinz's forces, and was now sure that winning a set-piece battle was his only option to continue the campaign. He returned, and the armies started to get into formation, both having a similar structure with infantry in the center and cavalry on the wings. The Sassanid army was deeper, as its commander made no attempts to widen his front and outflank the enemy, probably relying on the superiority of his troops and the fact that his second rank would be fresh when the time came. The battle started with Karinz calling for a duel. According to the Sassanid sources, duels were a way for the commanders to prove to the troops that they were ready to fall for them, so a personal combat between champions was a usual sight. Khalid wanted to answer the call, but one of the duelists who was near him galloped towards the Sassanid commander, and Khalid stayed back. In the ensuing duel, the Arab fighter was able to defeat his opponent. That demoralized the Sassanids, so Qubaz and Anushjan were probably forced to march forward and demand another duel to restore their morale. The Muslim wing commanders, Asim and Adi, galloped to them. Soon, the Sassanid commanders were dead, and Khalid ordered his entire army forward. Despite the fact that the Sassanids lost all of their top commanders, initially this charge was fruitless, as the forces of the Caliphate failed to make any headway and were even pushed back. But this pushback made the Sassanid lines disorganized, as the units lost cohesion due to the lack of command. Khalid was able to exploit this, and his counterattack created even more holes in the enemy formation. The rear of the Sassanid army attempted to retreat while the front was still fighting. However, left with no support, the front was soon massacred. Lightly equipped and fast Muslim troops were able to catch up to the fleeing Sassanids with ease, and the battle restarted along the river. The sources do not give a clear picture of what happened here, but most of the Sassanid losses occurred in that area, as some were killed, some drowned, and some were able to cross the river. By the end of the battle, the Shah's army lost anywhere from 15 to 30,000 troops, while Khalid's casualties were in the hundreds. After the victory at the Battle of the River, Khalid didn't cross into central Iraq, probably for a variety of reasons. Firstly, he needed to create a new administration in the region and start collecting taxes. Secondly, moving into the Sassanid Empire would have stretched his supply lines and would have put him into territory with no Arab tribes. On top of that, Khalid liked to fight on the edges of deserts, which gave him the opportunity to outmaneuver his opponents when needed. The Caliphate's commander established a new authority in the province, with its inhabitants starting to pay the jizya tax. Simultaneously, scouts from the local tribes were sent to the west and north to discover if the Sassanids had more armies nearby. As the Persian road and postal system were probably among the best of their time, the Shah learned about another defeat shortly after, and while Khalid was making his preparations, Yazdegerd ordered the troops from the northern and eastern parts of the empire to march towards the capital, Ctesiphon. A direct attack on the region controlled by Khalid was difficult, as the Arabs now controlled the crossings. So when the first army, commanded by Andarzaghar, arrived, it was sent towards the city of Walaja, the first strategic target on the road between Uvala and Al-Hira. It was expected that the Arabs would attack in this direction, so the remnants of the Sassanid forces which fought under Karinz joined Andarzaghar, bringing his numbers to somewhere between 25 and 30,000 troops. This army took positions outside of Walaja sometime in May. The second army was led by one of the top commanders in the Sassanid army, Bahman, and it was supposed to reinforce Andarzaghar if the Muslims indeed decided to move to Al-Hira. For now, this force of 20,000 was to be stationed along the Euphrates, halfway between Ubala and Walaja. Meanwhile, Khalid's scouts, being from the local tribes, were able to gather information with impunity, so he seemingly knew about every enemy move. He decided that his smaller force needed to defeat one of the armies opposing him, and he could not allow them to reinforce each other. So he left a minor garrison around Ubala and marched west, hoping to defeat Andarzaghar without alerting Bahman. Along the way, Khalid reinforced his army from the Arab tribes, which were now more eager to join his ranks, since the tax imposed by him was lower than the one they had to pay before, and that brought his numbers to around 15 to 20,000. The goal was to destroy the army under Andarzaghar before Bahman could reinforce it. Although Bahman's army noticed the movement of the Arabs, they were much slower, so Khalid was able to reach Andarzaghar well before Bahman, sometime in the second half of May. According to the sources, Andarzaghar had enough room to maneuver and wait for Bahman along the river, but he was confident in his troops and kept his position. For almost a day, the two armies seemingly remained in their respective camps, within reach of each other, without attempting to start a battle. The Arabs were probably resting after their forced march, and the Sassanids were hoping that this wait meant they might be reinforced. However, this wait couldn't last, since Khalid knew that he had to score a decisive victory before the second Sassanid army arrived. So on the next day, both forces formed up in standard formation with a center and two wings. The battlefield near Walaja was an even plain stretching between two low, flat ridges, which were about 1 kilometer away from each other. To the northeast was a barren desert, with the river Kasif running close to the eastern ridge. Both armies had the ridges behind them, meaning that an attack from the rear was not possible to begin with. The Sassanid leader was surprised to see the whole Muslim army was smaller than previously reported, and that it only consisted of footmen, which contradicted what he had heard about the crucial role Khalid's cavalry played in the previous battles. Despite that, he was convinced that his position was impenetrable and decided to wait, as both armies knew that Bahman couldn't be too far away. Indeed, the Muslim commander ordered his entire army forward. Led by Khalid, who fought in the front rank, the army of the Caliphate charged into the enemy. For an hour or so, the two lines fought to a standstill, losing few warriors. But the Sassanids had the numbers, so their tired front line was replaced by the rear rank, which gave them the edge. Despite Khalid's personal martial skill, his troops were getting tired, so Andarzaghar's counterattack started to push the Muslim troops back. Slowly but surely, the Sassanids advanced, while the Arabs were getting dangerously close to the ridge, which would have made any retreat impossible. At this point, Khalid gave a signal that changed the course of the battle. The cavalry that he sent into the desert during the previous night appeared on the eastern ridge behind the Sassanid army. This was Khalid's trademark move, as his mobile cavalry was able to hide in the deserts with ease. The advance of the Sassanid army away from its fortified position meant that its rear was undefended. The light Arab horsemen charged into the Sassanid lines, while Khalid's infantry lengthened their front to envelop the wings of Andarzaghar's army. Minutes later, the Battle of Walaja was over. The Sassanid commander was dead, and his army was completely destroyed, with only 5,000 survivors managing to retreat from the field. Khalid's casualties were around 3,000. As Khalid's troops were tired after the long march and the battle, his army wasn't able to pursue the Sassanid survivors. Those were mostly the Christian Arabs who were more mobile, and they managed to find shelter in nearby Elis. The messengers from this group went to other Christian Arab tribes to the northwest asking for help, and also informed the Shah in Ctesiphon. The tribes answered the call of their kin, while Yazdegerd sent messengers to Bahman to go towards Elis. It is not clear why, as Arab and Persian sources are conflicted, but according to the former, Bahman gave command over his army to another general called Jaban, who marched with the entire army to where the Christian Arabs were concentrating. The Persian sources claim that Bahman returned to Ctesiphon with his entire army. Meanwhile, Khalid moved his troops towards the city, and sometime in May, fought the allied Christian Arab and Sassanid army near Elis. The details of the battle are lost, but we know that the Muslims won. The sources are once again conflicted on the number of casualties, with the Arab sources stating that Khalid's force killed 70,000 enemies, mostly through the executions after the battle, while the Persian writers think that the army facing Khalid's 18,000 was comparable in size and managed to retreat towards Al-Hira after a minor defeat. In any case, in the last days of May, Khalid approached Al-Hira, which was the initial goal of his campaign. Again, the sources are inconclusive. We know that the local Sassanid garrison and their Arab allies mounted resistance for a few days, but eventually the sides decided to negotiate. As Khalid promised to spare the lives of the population in exchange for the payment of the jizya tax, the locals decided to surrender. The Arab commander spent the next few months building up a new administration in the region and collecting taxes. At the same time, raiding parties were sent to central Iraq and towards the border of the Eastern Roman Empire, and this raiding brought both loot and information on enemy movement. Some sources claim that the caliphate gained a degree of control over central Iraq, but it seems that Khalid didn't have enough troops to keep such a wide region under his authority. Still, the caliphate's raiding parties were not getting much resistance to the north and northeast, while his scouts informed him that the Sassanid garrisons to the northwest were still intact, with larger concentrations at Anbar and Ain al-Tamur. The first one was further away, and the direct route to it was through Ain al-Tamur, but attacking the fort of Anbar would have been more unexpected. So, in late June of 633, Khalid left half of his troops in Al-Hira and marched west towards Anbar with a 10,000-strong army. Anbar would become the first Arab attack across the Euphrates River. The details of the engagement that happened here are unclear, but it seems that Khalid's decision to attack Anbar surprised his opponents, and the leader of the garrison, Shirzad, was forced to surrender after the Arab archers showed their effectiveness. Then the caliphate's raiding parties approached the town of Ain al-Tamur from the direction of Al-Hira, so when Khalid engaged the Sassanid troops, mostly made up of Christian Arabs from the west, in July, he was able to win with relative ease. The leader of the Christian Arabs was taken prisoner and then executed, and the city surrendered to the Muslims. Events of the next few months between July and September are shrouded in mystery, as some sources claim that Khalid was staying in Anbar and Ain al-Tamur, slowly setting up the administration of the newly acquired region, which seems uncharacteristically passive for him. Others claim that the last two remnants of the apostate activity of the Ridda Wars were to the south, so Khalid moved most of his non-garrisoned troops towards Dawmat al-Jandal and helped his fellow caliphate general, Ayyad bin Ghanem, defeat the rebels in the region. This inactivity or absence gave some time to the Sassanids, and they started recruiting and concentrating five armies in the area between Muzayyah and Husayn. Kekah bin Amr, who was left to command the garrison at Al-Hira, ordered the raiding parties in central Iraq and the garrisons of Anbar and Ain al-Tamur to take positions to the south of the Sassanid forces delay them as much as possible, and not allow these four small armies to unite into one force. At the end of September, Khalid returned to Al-Hira alongside the troops he picked up around Dawmat al-Jandal and ordered Kaka bin Amr and Abu Layla to lead portions of the garrison to Husayd and Kenafis respectively and take command, while his troops rested in the city. Apparently, small Muslim and Sassanid armies fought minor battles in October, and the Sassanids suffered minor defeats, which compelled them to retreat towards Muzia. Khalid now had an open route to the Sassanid capital, Ctesiphon, but the Sassanid army at Muzia and the concentrations of the Christian Arabs in the area between Sani'i and Zumail were still a threat, so the Caliphate commander decided against attacking Ctesiphon. The main Sassanid army at Muzia probably considered its position to be safe, since it would be difficult to attack them without going through Sani'i and Zumail. At the same time, Khalid knew that attacking the majority light cavalry Arab Christians could push them to the north to unite with the troops at Muzia, so Khalid devised a plan. His army was already divided into three corps, and they moved directly against the Persians using the desert to avoid Sani'i and Zumail. This was technically very difficult, as all three corps had to not only bypass the enemy armies without being detected, but also arrive at the decided location simultaneously. It was risky, but the possible reward was also high. Everything worked as planned. Khalid's corps converged on the target at the same time, and during one of the nights in the first week of November, his 20,000 attacked the sleeping Sassanid army of comparable size. The latter was not expecting this attack, and the army of the Caliphate scored an easy victory, killing more than 10,000 Sassanid warriors. After that, defeating a smaller Christian Arab force seemed easy, but instead of confronting them head-on, Khalid repeated his three-pronged maneuver to avoid losses. The Muslims suffered minimal losses, while the Christian Arabs lost more than half of their army. Apparently, a few recent Muslim converts were among the killed, and their families sent an appeal to the Caliph, Abu Bakr, to punish Khalid. This rejected appeal was sent through the future Caliph Umar, and will become important for our story down the line. Khalid's mobility and the inability of his opponents to consolidate their forces meant that the region between Muzia and Al-Hira was now under the control of the Caliphate. We have sparse information on the early administration of these lands. The Muslim sources claim that while the Persians living in the cities were often taken captive and enslaved, the local Arab population was forced to pay the jizya tax, but was otherwise allowed a degree of autonomy and even freedom of worship. More raids were sent across the Euphrates in the next month, while Khalid was contemplating what his next move should be. Attacking Ctesiphon was still dangerous, as that would have stretched the supply lines too much. That made an attack on the only Sassanid target in the area, the city of Firaz, the only option. Firaz was right on the border of the Sassanid and Eastern Roman empires. Khalid and his 20,000 reached the area in December. Once again, the sources are conflicted, but a few details that have reached our times allow us to form a coherent timeline. We know that the local Sassanid and Roman garrisons united their strength on the north side of the Euphrates, while Khalid held the crossing on the other side. Despite the fact that the Muslim sources state that the united Roman-Sassanid force was large, it is fair to assume that neither empire could have a large force in the area, since the Sassanids needed those troops in central Iraq, while the Romans were concentrating their own forces on the crucial coastal areas and urban centers already being raided by the smaller Muslim armies. Even with a united force and the inclusion of the local Arab tribes, the allies, led by the Sassanid commander, Hormozd Jadhuyi, probably had between 15 and 25,000 troops. For 5 or 6 weeks, the armies remained opposite each other, as neither side had a safe place to cross the river. It seems that sometime in the third week of January, Khalid slightly retreated from the positions he held, perhaps baiting his counterpart into attacking. Indeed, the Allied force crossed the river and formed up against the Muslims. Both sides had a similar disposition, with infantry in the center and cavalry on the wings. The Allied army charged the Muslims, probably hopeful that their heavier equipment would give them an advantage. Slowly but surely, this charge pushed Khalid's lines back. Simultaneously, the Muslim general ordered the cavalry units from the second rank to leave the main body and take position to the far left. The Roman Sassanid army continued to advance, and the Muslims retreated even further. Khalid's detached force was ordered to take the bridge and then attack the allies from the rear. This maneuver was successful, and Hormuz Jadhuyih's army immediately started losing cohesion. The allies thought that there was another big Muslim army that took the bridge and would soon surround them. Simultaneously, Khalid's main force started their counterattack, and those units of the Allied army not killed on the spot started routing towards the northeast. A certain number managed to swim across the river, but more than half of the Allied army was killed. Khalid lost a few hundred from his ranks. Khalid was about to attack deeper into Persian territory, but he soon after received a letter from the Caliph, Abu Bakr, at the Rashidun capital of Medina. The letter ordered him to cease his attacks on the Sassanids and to move into Syria to battle the Romans. So, Khalid and a small contingent of his army prepared to move west. As with the Mesopotamian invasions, there had probably been no better opportunity for a strike into Roman lands, as the destructive quarter-century-long conflict from 602 to 628 had undermined crucial defenses in both regions. The Roman East, with all its religious, cultural, financial, and strategic significance, was now dangerously vulnerable. During 633, the Muslims sent four separate corps to invade Palestine, in addition to the areas around the Sea of Galilee, the River Jordan, and the Dead Sea. Though they achieved success, assaults on the large urban settlements of the region could not be considered until reinforcements were brought up. So, both for the additional troops and for Khalid's expertise in warfare, Abu Bakr sent the order for him to move west. To save time and to bypass Roman defenses, the Muslim general chose a more dangerous route through an especially desolate, waterless stretch of the Syrian desert, much to the alarm of his sub-commanders. In order to survive, it is reported that Khalid, in his ingenuitive way, ordered 20 camels be forced to drink large amounts of water so that they could be used as makeshift storage tanks. The beasts were then periodically slaughtered along the journey when nourishment was needed, and the water was then harvested from the camels. After 5 grueling days of marching through this desolate landscape, the 9,000-strong Muslim army emerged at Suwa. Then they swiftly inflicted a minor defeat on the Roman Arab clients, the Ghassanids, at Marj al-Rahit, while they were celebrating Easter. Proving his strategy correct, Khalid's improbable desert crossing had also neutralized the Byzantine defenses on the Arabian border. Now he turned south, towards the Syrian town of Basra, where the arrival of his reinforcements led to its capture by mid-July of 634. Despite this success, the Muslims had little time to celebrate. Roman Emperor Heraclius, who was now in Emesa, sent his brother Theodore and an Armenian general named Wardan south towards Ajnadayn, 25 miles southeast of Jerusalem, where they began to gather a large army. Spies reported this gathering force to the invaders, and the burgeoning Caliphate's army marched to meet their Byzantine opponents. Very few hard facts are known about this battle, but we can reconstruct a version of the fight using the available sources. Muslim accounts vastly exaggerate the number of Roman troops they faced, and it is likely even that the weakened Byzantine forces in Syria, 10,000 strong and commanded by Wardan and Theodore, were outnumbered by the 15,000 Muslims. both armies formed up in extended lines with their camps to the rear, and both sides stood ready with three divisions of infantry, right, left, and center, while each wing had a cavalry flank guard. Behind the Muslim center was a small reserve, and in front of their center was a small group of champions. Before the battle began, a Christian bishop rode over to Khalid's army and attempted to negotiate a Muslim withdrawal. However, the Rashidun general simply responded by offering the traditional choice: conversion to Islam, payment of the jizya tax, or death in battle. The fighting at Ajnadayn began when the Byzantine auxiliary missile units, stationed ahead of the main line, began to rain arrows and stones on their adversaries. As the superior Byzantine ranged units loosed, the Muslims suffered losses and were unable to respond. However, one Muslim warrior named Dirar, heavily armored and brandishing a heavy shield, stolen from a Roman soldier, marched directly into the arrow fire, shouting his war cry. After the hail of missiles ceased, Dirar and his entourage of fellow champions were met by their Byzantine counterparts, and it is said the Muslims got the better of the fighting, slaying several Roman elite warriors and two generals. As the dueling came to an end, the Rashidun army attacked, and the subsequent fighting was a slogging match with little maneuver and lasted until nightfall. The next day, Byzantine commander Wardan attempted to lure Khalid into a trap by offering a parley, but the plan went wrong and he was instead killed by the fearsome Dirar. Aiming to exploit the confusion which this loss of leadership caused in the Roman ranks, the Arabs attacked again, with their flanks in front and center behind. After savage hand-to-hand fighting, which exhausted and depleted both armies, Khalid deployed his 4,000-strong reserve in the center and drove deep wedges through the Roman formations in this area. Unable to withstand the pressure any further, their line collapsed. After this defeat, Emperor Heraclius sent his brother Theodore back to Constantinople in disgrace. At the same time, the remnants of his shattered army, in addition to the local Roman population, withdrew to the apparent safety of the walled cities, which subsequently became crowded with refugees. Perhaps an omen of things to come, Heraclius then retreated with his headquarters further north to the city of Antioch, due to the fact that Muslim forces now controlled the countryside and were expected to advance on the most prominent urban center in the area. A week after their victory at Ajnadayn, the Arab forces began to march north in the direction of Damascus. On their way, they had to leave a mounted detachment at the city of Fahl, ancient Pella, to keep the Roman garrison there tied down while the main army marched onward. After this was done, the Muslims reached Yakusa on the southern bank of the Yarmouk River. Here they were opposed by a blocking force of Byzantine troops on the northern shore. They were in no real position to offer serious permanent resistance, but they were there to delay the invaders and to allow the great city to further prepare for a coming siege. After a short battle here and another battle against 12,000 Romans at the Yellow Meadow, otherwise known as Major Safar, the road was clear to Damascus. When the invading Arabs neared the city, the Muslim commander realized that his forces were not numerous enough to encircle it entirely. Instead, each of the Muslim sub-commanders stationed their contingents outside of the city's various gates, fully blockading the crucial thoroughfares by August 21st with a total of around 20,000 soldiers, 16,000 infantry, and 4,000 mobile guard cavalry. Damascus immediately began starving due to the lack of supplies and unpreparedness for a siege, while the Muslims were well supplied due to their domination of the fertile and productive local countryside. As the swift Arab light horsemen were relatively useless in a siege, Khalid ibn al-Walid sent a few hundred of them to the Eagle's Pass to the north in order to act as scouts. Here they watched for any Byzantine relief force aiming to pass through this choke point. The other half stayed near the city as a reserve, ready to help repel any sortie made by the Romans. In Antioch, the Roman emperor learned of the siege and sent a 12,000-strong relief force, along with plentiful supplies, to help Damascus on September 9th. When this force reached the narrow pass where the Muslim scouts were stationed, they pushed the cavalry back. One of these scouts managed to send notice to Al-Walid, and he, gambling that repelling the relief attempt was more important than maintaining too tight a blockade, took the remaining cavalry at night to the Eagle Pass, where he managed to rout the Romans. Despite their apparent success, the besieging Arab forces were now stretched thin by Khalid's withdrawal. Historians believe that if the garrison's general Thomas had chosen to launch a sortie at this point, the Byzantines could have broken the siege, but they did not and therefore lost the opportunity. It seems that Al-Walid realized he had put the siege in danger with his gamble, and he hurriedly returned to Damascus after he attained victory at the Eagle's Pass. As the garrison and Thomas realized that no relief was coming, morale among the defenders of Damascus became weaker and weaker. It was clear action would be needed. So, the emperor's son-in-law decided to launch a counter-offensive of his own. For this first attack, Thomas decided to concentrate on one specific section of the city, drawing men together from all sectors of the city towards the Gate of Thomas, where he was faced by around 5,000 soldiers under Shurabil. After the defending soldiers gathered in the area, the Byzantine commander began his sortie by ordering his archers to rain down a constant stream of arrows against their enemy, to which the Arabs responded accordingly. Using the cover granted by the Roman missile units, the infantry rushed through the Gate of Thomas and fanned out into battle formation, with Thomas himself leading the assault. During the subsequent skirmish, it is reported that Thomas both broke through a section of the Muslim line and almost killed Shurabil, but he was then shot in the eye by the widow of a slain Arab soldier. Despite some level of success, the sortie had failed to break the siege, and the Byzantine forces retreated into the city. As they did, it is said that the injured Roman leader swore to take 1,000 eyes in return for his own. That night, another plan to break the siege was devised by the defenders. As a concentrated attack on one of the gates had failed, Thomas would this time launch simultaneous strikes from four of the gates. Two large forces were gathered, at the eastern gate where Khalid was in command, and at the Gate of Thomas, where the main attack against exhausted enemy units would be undertaken. The other forces at the small gate and the Jabiya gate were designed to pin their besiegers in place. As Thomas sounded the attack, a grinding battle took place at the Jabiya gate, with both sides suffering many losses. After a while of this slaughter, Abu Ubaidah and his forces at this gate managed to doggedly repulse the Byzantine assault, driving them back into the city. The situation was far more serious at the eastern gate, where the Byzantines had a larger force. This larger contingent of defenders managed to break the Arab infantry and drive them back, but Khalid himself then arrived with 400 elite mobile guard cavalry, and with them struck the Roman flank. This weakened the sortie irreversibly, and the defenders were slowly driven back inside the gates. Once again, however, the worst of the fighting occurred at the Gate of Thomas. Here, the Byzantine forces were led by the one-eyed Thomas himself, and after intense fighting, there was still no weakness in the Muslim ranks. At this point, the Roman commander seems to have realized there was no point in continuing the grinding melee, and commanded a slow, steady withdrawal. All the while, the Arab archers continually showered his men with arrows. This was the last effort by Thomas to break the Muslim siege, and it had failed with the loss of thousands of men. With this defeat, he could no longer afford any more attempts at a breakout. A Greek in Damascus, known as Jonah the Lover in Arab sources, climbed over the wall and informed Khalid that on the night of the 18th of September there would be a Christian religious ceremony which would leave the walls relatively unguarded. He supposedly betrayed his city because his marriage to his fiancée had been interrupted by the siege, and, frustrated, asked for the Muslims' help in obtaining said bride. This man soon converted to Islam, but the details are incredibly vague. Whatever the case, details of the opportunity led Khalid to borrow ladders from a local monastery and to purchase ropes in order to form an assault party. That night, a 100-strong contingent, led by the Muslim general himself, climbed the walls, dropped into the city and killed the guards at the eastern gate. Then the attackers flung open the gate and let the remainder of the Muslim forces at the eastern gate inside the city. The other Byzantine detachments stationed elsewhere were unaware of this surprising development, and instead of helping, stayed at their posts. At the same time, Khalid began to fight his way towards the center of the city. Now attempting to save the city for a final time, Thomas sent envoys to Abu Ubaidah at the western Jabiya gate, offering surrender and a payment of the jizya in exchange for a capitulation by terms. This was given by the supposedly peace-loving Abu Ubaidah. However, Khalid, who had finished slaughtering his way to the center of the city, was furious that a surrender had been allowed even though the city had technically been taken by storm. Nevertheless, the many Muslim unit commanders agreed that a surrender would be honored. Khalid reluctantly accepted this judgment. The fall of Damascus was a shock for the Byzantines, as they probably thought that the Muslim attack on the region was a massive raid and not a full-on invasion. Syria and Egypt were the most important provinces of the empire, and the fall of the former would mean that the land route to the latter was cut, and it was now also vulnerable to being occupied. Emperor Heraclius couldn't allow that, so he started sending orders to the provinces in order to bring in more reinforcements to the region. Simultaneously, the political situation in the caliphate had also changed, as Caliph Abu Bakr passed away in late August of that year, and was replaced by Umar. The new caliph immediately started implementing administrational and military reforms, creating new administrative positions in the provinces, and changing the formation of the army from the one created on the tribal principle to a more centralized one. Immediately after his ascension, Umar sent a letter to the army, relieving Khalid of his post and appointing Abu Ubaidah in his place. We don't know if this was part of the reforms, or, as some sources claim, it happened due to the previous animosity between the new caliph and the general. In any case, it seems that before the messengers could reach Damascus, the three-day peace the Muslims promised Thomas had passed, and Khalid, alongside 5,000 cavalry, guided by Jonah, started pursuing the Romans. Thomas had around 10,000 people with him, both soldiers and citizens of Damascus, but instead of finding refuge in one of the nearby towns, this group was heading towards Antioch, and that allowed the Arab cavalry to catch up to them to the south of Latakia sometime in late September. The details of the engagement, now known as the Battle of Maraj al-Dabaj, are scarce, but according to the Muslim sources, a cavalry detachment of a few hundred caught up and took position to the south of Thomas. The Romans immediately noticed them, deciding that they would be able to defeat this small group with ease. To the surprise of the Romans, as soon as the Arab cavalry and Roman infantry started fighting, another group of Khalid's horsemen appeared to the east. Although the Romans had thousands of refugees in their midst, they still outnumbered the Muslims, and a portion of their infantry formed up to face the new threat. However, a half hour after the battle was joined here, a third group of Arab cavalry started charging from the north, and the Romans barely got into a defensive formation in time to prevent it from breaking through. Thomas's situation was becoming dangerous, as the route to Damascus was now cut off, but the Romans were still fighting on an equal footing, and the battle raged on three sides. An hour later, Khalid himself appeared to the west with the largest part of his army and charged the Romans. Despite the fact that Thomas managed to get a few units to this front, they were swept aside almost immediately, and the Arab cavalry was now deep inside the Roman formation. Thomas was soon killed. The Roman resistance continued for some time, but was broken within an hour. Some soldiers and refugees managed to slip away to the north, but the majority of the Romans were either killed or captured. Khalid lost just a few hundred troops. Immediately afterwards, the Arabs headed to Damascus and reached it in early October. Apparently, Abu Ubaidah already received the messenger from the Caliph and informed Khalid of his demotion. According to sources, the latter accepted it without much protest, but it did change the flow of the Caliphate's expansion in the region. Abu Ubaidah was much slower and more deliberate than Khalid. Umar preferred a more hands-on approach to the armies, often issuing orders after every engagement, which slowed down the campaigns due to the distance to Medina. He even placed informers in the army, which made Abu Ubaidah even more careful in his decisions. At the same time, the Muslims received some reinforcements, bringing the total number of their troops to 30,000. However, that wasn't the only change in command made by Umar, which brings us back to Iraq, where Khalid left Muthanna in charge of a 9,000-strong army in 634. For the next few months, Muthanna, whose numbers weren't enough to conquer any more lands, implemented the tactic of raids in order to keep the superior Sassanid forces at bay. The details are lost to time, but the Sassanids, who were used to fighting in pitched battles, were having a difficult time containing the raids, and one of them even reached Babylon. The best Sassanid commander, Rostam, who basically controlled the court of the 10-year-old Shah Yezdegerd, was reluctant to leave the capital, worried that it might incite another revolt. But Muthanna's raids were too dangerous, so the general decided to take command over the forces in Iraq and marched south, supported by the Sassanid generals Bahman, Jaban, and Narsi, and the Armenian noble Jalinus. Even before this multi-pronged counterattack began, Muthanna knew that he needed reinforcements and sent a messenger to the capital. By August, this messenger was in Medina, just in time for the ascension of Umar. The new caliph appointed Abu Ubaid, not to be confused with Abu Ubaidah, to command in Iraq and gave him 6,000 or so troops to reinforce Muthanna. The latter was now informed of the Sassanid counterattack, and when Jaban got close to Al-Hira in late September, the Arab commander abandoned it, retreating to Kafan. By early October, Abu Ubaid joined him, bringing the total strength of the Caliphate's force to more than 15,000, a similar number to that commanded by Jaban, who crossed the Euphrates and was now at Namariq. The details of the battle at Namariq are not clear, but it seems that Jaban suffered a minor defeat and was forced to retreat beyond the river. Abu Ubaid decided to fight the approaching Sassanid armies in detail and marched north towards Kaskar, hoping to defeat the smaller army under Narsi and knock him out. Although the Muslims won again, the Persian army managed to retreat mostly intact, and Abu Ubaid, who knew that Jalinus might cut his retreat to Al-Hira, moved his army double time to prevent this from happening. Indeed, the army of the Caliphate reached the city before Jalinus blocked them. The closest Sassanid armies to Al-Hira were those of Jalinus and Bahman. A letter from Rostam ordered them to unite their troops, cross the Euphrates, and attack the city. In late October of 634, their united armies, numbering around 20,000, attempted to force the river near Kufa, but Abu Ubaid and his 15,000 were able to halt this crossing. For some time, the armies stood in front of each other screaming insults, until a Sassanid emissary approached Abu Ubaid with Bahman's message: "Either you cross over to our side and we shall let you, or we shall cross over to your side and you must let us." Although his officers protested it, Abu Ubaid was eager to cross and fight in a pitched battle, so he ordered his army to do that. Seeing this, Bahman repositioned his troops slightly to the north, allowing the Muslims to move across and form up. Unlike previous battles, the Persians had a dozen or so elephants, and they were placed in the vanguard with heavy cavalry between them and the infantry in the second echelon. Abu Ubaid's army crossed the river in 2 hours, and started to get into formation, once again with horsemen in front and the footmen in the second line. Bahman continued to wait, and it was Abu Ubaid who gave the order to his soldiers to attack. The Arab cavalry galloped forward, but their horses were scared of the elephants, probably seeing them for the first time, and the charge stopped before it managed to reach the Sassanid lines. In response, Bahman moved his archers to the front and commanded them to shoot at the retreating Arabs. The volleys killed and wounded many, and when the leaders of the army of the Caliphate attempted to move their archers forward to start skirmishing, the whole Arab line became chaotic and disjointed. The Persian commander used that and directed his cavalry and elephants to attack. While the cavalry was mostly stopped, the elephants easily created wedges everywhere they struck. The Arab army was slowly but surely forced back. The presence of the elephants was panicking the horses, so in order to stabilize the front, Abu Ubaid commanded his horsemen to dismount. He led a group of warriors himself, killing a few elephants and their entourages. However, another elephant was sent towards the Arab leader, and soon he was killed by the beast. Many other Muslim leaders were killed, and their army started fleeing in chaos, and the Sassanids started chasing them. Muthanna was one of the last remaining commanders, and he achieved some degree of discipline and organization at the crossing, leading the rearguard and allowing the remainder of the army to retreat. He was badly wounded during the fight, but his actions saved thousands. The Battle of the Bridge was the first battle the Persians won in this war. More than 10,000 Muslims lay dead, while the Sassanid casualties were around 2,000. Over the following weeks, Bahman didn't pursue Muthanna, who withdrew to Ulaes, and returned to Ctesiphon. Some sources claim that there was another rebellion against Rostam, others that Bahman was sent to deal with the Turkic raiders. The sources are also conflicted on the events that happened in Iraq later in 634 and then in 635, with some chronicles asserting that Muthanna's army deserted and he abandoned all the previous conquests, and others stating that the Sassanids sent a large army under Mihran and it was decisively defeated at Buwayb in April of 635. In any case, this lull in action allows us to return to the Levant. The Muslim army was getting used to the new command structure, and using this pause, Heraclius was bringing more forces into the region, by land to Antioch, and, as the Romans had complete naval control, by sea to the various ports. The second group was to be commanded by Theodore Trithyrius, the treasurer of the empire, and in December of 634, it started assembling to the west of Pella, which was the perfect place to launch an eastward attack, cutting the line of communications with Arabia. It is not clear how big this army was. Spies had informed Abu Ubaidah about this threat in December, and in early January of 635, he marched south towards Pella, leaving a corps under Yazid behind. As soon as the small garrison of Pella learned of this, it retreated towards the main army, flooding the River Jordan and creating a swamp-like territory dividing the Byzantine and Arab armies. After occupying Pella, the Arab army commanders decided to move towards Baisan to engage Theodore. They didn't know the terrain of this area well, so soon after, the vanguard led by Khalid got stuck in the mud, and the Muslims were forced to withdraw back to Pella. Theodore waited for a week or so, hoping that his foes would become less vigilant. On the 23rd of January, he marched his troops towards the river with a plan to attack the Muslim camp at night. However, the Muslims had placed scout troops along the river, so as soon as the Romans started crossing, the Arab camp was informed of it and started to form up for battle. We have only limited details on the battle, which, according to the Arab sources, raged through the night and most of the next day. The Romans were able to push their counterparts back to the camp using their slightly larger numbers. According to one chronicle, Theodore was wounded in one of the charges, and the resultant loss of morale made the Romans retreat. When they began crossing a marsh, the Arabs used this to their advantage. They attacked, killing thousands. The rest returned to Baisan. Whatever was left of the Roman army dispersed into various garrisons to the west and south, while Theodore returned to Antioch by sea. There was no army to fight back against Abu Ubaidah, so he divided his army into corps to conquer as many cities as possible. Shurahbil took Baisan and then Tiberias. Afterwards, Shurahbil and Amr bin al-As went south, while Abu Ubaidah and Khalid marched north. By March of 635, the Muslims were in control of the whole region to the south of Beirut, save for Caesarea, which withstood a siege reinforced by Heraclius, and Jerusalem, which had the strongest fortifications. Heraclius probably thought that the Muslims would be busy with the sieges, and he had some time, so he was recruiting in order to counterattack in 636. Simultaneously, an alliance with Yazdegerd was established. Heraclius married his granddaughter to the young Sassanid Shah. It was planned that the Persians would attack Muslim positions from the east. Meanwhile, Abu Ubaidah's 15,000 were moving north, and by November, took over the territory between Damascus and Emesa, putting this major city in danger. Heraclius rushed reinforcements, which brought the strength of the garrison commanded by Harbes to 8,000. In early December, the city was besieged. Harbes hoped that the Arabs, who weren't used to the cold, would not be able to sustain the siege for too long. At the same time, Emesa was a well-fortified city, with walls 1 mile in diameter, a moat surrounding it, and a citadel within the walls, so the defender's situation wasn't hopeless. The Muslims weren't strong at the art of siegecraft at that point, and the lack of siege weapons made an assault impossible. So for weeks and then months, the sides did nothing but exchange arrow volleys. By March of 636, winter began to subside, and it was becoming clear that the Arab army was planning to starve the Emesans. Food supplies were getting dangerously low, so Harbes decided to sally out and kill as many foes as possible, believing that it might end the siege. He left small units to defend the walls and concentrated more than 5,000 near the southern gates. Initially, this sortie was very successful. The Muslims were caught unprepared and were outnumbered 2-1, which led to hundreds of casualties and forced them to retreat under Harbes's pressure. However, Khalid managed to get his cavalry together, arriving to the area of battle shortly after. The numbers were now on the Arab side, and this was enough for the Romans to break off the fight and return to the safety of the walls. The defenders were jubilant, and not at all surprised when the Muslim army gathered to the south and started withdrawing. Harbes decided that he could score a brilliant victory, and immediately marched out of the city with the same 5,000. He caught up with the retreating Muslims a few miles to the south, but as soon as his mounted troops started charging, Abu Ubaidah's units turned back and attacked. A few minutes later, the Romans were surrounded from all sides. Harbes was killed, and only a few hundred of his soldiers escaped. After a short battle, the Arabs returned to the city, and the garrison, which was left leaderless, surrendered. Meanwhile, to the north, Emperor Heraclius had been preparing an army to counterattack for some time. Various sources provide numbers of this army ranging from a very modest 30,000 to the fantastical 400,000. It should be noted that the chroniclers who wrote on this war lived at least one or two generations after the events, so their depictions weren't based on first or even second-hand accounts. We know that at the peak of the Byzantine-Sassanid War of 602-628, Heraclius was able to raise an army of 70,000 for his attack on the Sassanid Empire, but that army had a considerable Gurk-Turk element. At the same time, the Byzantines had to keep some forces in Italy, the Balkans and the Caucasus, in order to check the encroaching Lombards, Slavs, Avars and Khazars. In our opinion, the Byzantines outnumbered their opponents at least 2-1, but considering the logistical situation in the area of operation, their numbers were below 100,000. Heraclius, who was now in his 60s, suffered from edema, so he wasn't going to lead the army, predominantly made of Greeks, Armenians, and Christian Arabs, personally. Instead, the army was divided into five columns, commanded by five generals. The plan was to engage and surround the Muslim forces around Emesa, and use another column to take Damascus, and prevent the troops of the Caliphate operating to the south from reinforcing the northern group. The army left Antioch in the middle of June. Unfortunately for the Romans, a few days before their leading column reached Emesa, the Arabs learned about the counterattack, either from their spies or from the prisoners they took while raiding Shaizar. So Abu Ubaidah ordered his corps to fall back. Initially, the idea was to retreat to Damascus to preserve this conquest, but the city was surrounded by open space that would have given an army with superior numbers an advantage, so the Arabs started retreating towards Jabiya, which was located between the River Yarmouk to the south, Lake Tiberias to the west, and the desert to the east. Messengers were sent to the southern group with the order to march towards Jabiya. The Byzantines, who barely missed an opportunity to crush their opponents around Emesa, started chasing the Arabs, slowly coalescing after taking the city. They retook Damascus and continued south, and sometime in the middle of July 636, their vanguard made contact with the Caliphate's rearguard to the north of Jabiya. The Arab commanders, who initially liked their position, now understood that they might be attacked from the southwest, via the narrow passage between Lake Tiberias and the River Yarmouk. The Byzantine field army could have engaged them from the front, while the garrison of Caesarea might have attacked using the passage. Therefore, Abu Ubaidah left Khalid in command of the rearguard and started repositioning his troops. The latter engaged the Byzantine vanguard, led by the light Christian Arab horsemen, allowing the rest of the army to move unharassed. The Muslims encamped in the eastern part of the plain of Yarmouk. Some distance to the east of them were the lava hills, stretching from north to east of Ezra, and the mountains of Jabal ad-Druz. A few days later, probably in the last days of July, the Roman army entered the plain and built a fortified camp in its western part. With the central portion of the plain left unoccupied, the army started preparing for battle by scouting the enemy positions. The sources mention extensive negotiations, which continued for weeks, but the details of the talks are convoluted. In short, they ended in failure, and the battle was inevitable. According to some sources, the Caliph's reinforcements, consisting of 5,000 famous Yemeni archers and 1,000 footmen, who were veterans of the earliest Muslim campaigns in Arabia, joined the army sometime during this negotiation. The battlefield was enclosed on its western and southern sides by deep ravines. To the west, Wadi Ur-Rakad flowed into the Yarmouk River near Yekisa. This stream ran northeast to southwest for 11 miles through a deep ravine with very steep banks. The ravine was crossable at a few places, but there was only one main crossing, where the village of Kafir Ulmar stands today. South of the battlefield ran the canyon of the Yarmouk River, while deserts occupied the north and east of it. The plain was mostly flat, save for a small hill called Samain. On the 14th of August, the Roman army moved forward and started forming up to the east and north of Alan. It is debated whether the army was commanded by the Armenian general Vahan, or each of the five corps had a separate leader. The Byzantine army positioned itself as follows. The light Ghassanid cavalry of Jabala was stretched across the plain as the vanguard, with the objective of screening the army and skirmishing with the enemy. Kanatir commanded the left flank, while Grigori was on the right flank, and two central corps were led by Derjan and Vahan. The Romans had spear and sword infantry in the first rank, archers in the second, and cavalry behind them. Although Abu Ubaidah was the overall commander appointed by the Caliph, sources claim that he allowed Khalid to be the one giving the orders. The Muslim force matched the widths of the Roman army, but as it was smaller, its formation wasn't as deep. Khalid moved some of his light cavalry to the vanguard to observe the Romans. The infantry was divided into four corps, made up of nine units each, with infantry in the front and archers behind them. There were three cavalry units behind each flank and center, while Khalid's mobile cavalry unit served as a reserve. The Arab commander's plan was to defend and tire his foe, and then counterattack when possible. Both armies had a southern flank secured by the River Yarmouk, while the northern flank bordering the desert offered a chance to outflank the enemy. The Battle of Yarmouk started on August 15, 636, with the Roman light cavalry vanguard moving behind the main army, mostly reinforcing the left flank cavalry. The Arab vanguard did the same and joined the main cavalry units. It is unusual to see a battle fought in this era which wasn't started by a clash of light skirmishers, but the sources didn't mention this happening, instead insisting that the champions of both sides dueled for a few hours. In any case, after the screening forces pulled back, a third of the Roman infantry advanced across the front at midday. Soon the Roman footmen clashed with their counterparts, while the archers in the second rank skirmished, sending volleys above the heads of their infantry. The details of this first day are scarce, but it is possible that the Byzantines decided that a reconnaissance in force would provide benefits. Their attack was slow and lacked determination. After a few hours of fighting, they disengaged and returned to their initial positions. The first day of battle was over, and the sides returned to their respective camps. At night, a few Roman light cavalry units moved forward, but they were caught by their Arab counterparts and forced back. These raids were seemingly disjointed and lacked an objective, as they were not conducted by nearly enough troops to do much damage. However, they allowed the Romans to form up in the darkness without alerting the enemy. The plan was to attack the Muslims as early as possible, not giving them the opportunity to get into formation. Indeed, the whole Roman army attacked before dawn. Some sources claim they knew of the Muslim religious rites, that one of their prayers happened at this time, and decided to use it to their advantage. Unfortunately for the attackers, the same light cavalry patrols who fought them during the night were ordered to remain in front, and as soon as the Romans came into contact with these forward units, the Arabs retreated to their main force and informed them of the impending attack. To the surprise of the Romans, their foes managed to prepare for the attack. However, they had their orders, and so the second day of the battle began. The Roman plan was to tie up the Muslim army's center and pressure its wings. To that end, the attack in the middle was relatively passive. The Byzantine left attacked the Muslim right head-on. The first two attempts to break through failed, but the Byzantines had a numerical advantage and used it. Fresh troops moved to the front, and the third attack pushed the Arabs back. Some of them started retreating towards their camp, and some joined the center right. This opened a way for a counterattack by the Arab right-wing cavalry. Its charge wasn't strong enough to force the Romans back, but tied them up for some time, allowing the infantry to retreat. Soon the cavalry was unable to withstand the pressure and also retreated. Later Muslim sources mention that the wives of the retreating warriors shamed them into returning to the battle. We don't know if that is true, but the Arab right flank reformed and started marching towards the approaching enemy. Meanwhile, the Roman right, which was probably made of the best heavy infantry in the empire, was even more successful. Some sources mention that it was fighting in a testudo formation, but that is probably an anachronism. In any case, the first or the second attack by this group drove the Muslim left flank back, and they hastily retreated towards the camp. Similar to what happened on the other side of the battlefield, the Muslim cavalry attempted to stem the enemy advance with a counterattack, but it failed, and the horsemen joined their infantry en route to the camp. The sources once again claim that their wives urged them to return to the battle and even threw stones at their husbands. As the Roman right was slower due to its heavier armor, the Arabs had more time to rearrange their line and move towards the Romans. An attentive viewer might ask why the Byzantines didn't exploit these breakthroughs by pouring troops between the gaps in the Muslim formations, or by outflanking the enemy right by widening the front. In truth, we don't have answers to these questions, but it can be assumed that the fresh Muslim cavalry in the center and in the reserve probably discouraged the former, while the latter was dangerous due to the fact that the Arabs had already used desert terrain numerous times in the past to outflank the Byzantines. It was noon, and Khalid had just been watching the battle until that moment, but seeing the return of the wings spurred him into action, taking command of the cavalry in the center. First, his united cavalry force charged to the right, and moments after joining up with the right wing, attacked the enemy left. The Romans didn't expect an attack from the flank, and were forced to retreat to their original positions, losing men along the way. To the south, the left of the Caliphate's army was about to engage the Byzantine right. Initially, the Arabs were getting the worst of the fight, and were about to break and flee again. However, Khalid was on his way. He sent one unit of his cavalry to exploit the gap between the enemy right and center right, and charged the rest into the side of the Roman right. As mentioned, this was the best Roman infantry, so they resisted longer than their counterparts, and suffered fewer casualties, but still retreated. The cavalry unit sent to attack the Roman center right surprised the latter, managing to break in and killing the commander of this group. The Romans recovered from their surprise and pushed back the attackers. However, seeing that their flanks were retreating, the center also broke off and returned to their starting positions. Both parties probably suffered similar casualties, with the majority of the Arab losses during the early retreat. The Roman right lost the most troops, and that would prove to be important during the next day, as this detachment started its advance alongside the whole army, but stopped well short of the enemy army, with archers on both sides entering a half-hearted skirmishing contest. Meanwhile, the Roman center right engaged the Arabs, but this attack only served to tie up this portion of the opposing army. The main attack targeted the right and center right of the Muslim army, and although initially the Roman onslaught was slowed, their numbers started to play a role. The Muslims started to retreat, especially on the right flank, where their line was pressed all the way up to the camp yet again. This allowed the Romans to increase the pressure on the rightmost units of the Muslim center right and start turning the line. Amir's corps finally reformed and returned to the battle, but all their efforts only managed to stabilize the line. The Arab cavalry in the second line attempted to outflank the Romans, but Kanateer moved his own to block off this advance. Seeing that the Roman right was being passive, Khalid deduced that his left was safe. He moved the reserve cavalry to the right and charged the Roman flank. The Byzantine commander attempted to move more troops from his second rank to widen his front, and it worked for some time. However, the Romans now lacked their previous depth, and with this advantage negated, the Arabs in the other parts of the line started to push back. Approaching dusk, the continuation of the battle became impossible, and the attackers disengaged, retiring to their initial line. It is clear that the Romans were getting frustrated, as they expected their numbers to prevail at this point in the engagement. In the first 3 days, the Romans probably lost more troops, but they still outnumbered their foe. Meanwhile, for Khalid, the main worry was the losses among the Yemeni archers and on the right flank. The Roman plan for the next day was to attack the right half of the Caliphate's army to divide it and encircle each corps separately, and then do the same with the left half. To that end, their left attacked the Muslims, and soon the right flank of Khalid's army was shoved back yet again, but not as far as in previous days. Made up mostly of the Armenians, the Roman center left was equally successful against the Muslim center right. This time the Roman troops were able to turn this portion of the Arab line, which opened up space between their corps, and the Christian Arab light cavalry, which was stationed in reserve behind the center, was commanded to charge into this gap. The Muslims were suffering heavy casualties, and it was becoming clear that Khalid needed to move to the area to stop the Romans from winning. Before he did that, though, he sent word to the left and center left, ordering them to advance and tie up the forces in front of them. With that, the Arab commander divided his cavalry into two halves. One of them moved to the left and attacked the Armenians from the side and rear, while Khalid himself moved against the Christian Arabs. The arrival of the reinforcements invigorated the beleaguered Muslims, and they counterattacked. The fight here continued for a few hours, until eventually the Muslims started gaining the upper hand. Engaged from three sides, the more heavily armored and disciplined Armenians suffered some casualties, but were still able to retreat in relative order. Their Christian Arab allies weren't as able to defend themselves, and lost many hundreds before they were able to return to their initial position. Seeing that their center had fallen back, the Roman left also disengaged. However, the left half of the Muslim army was still in melee. Initially, the Arabs had the upper hand, as their charge surprised the Romans, but their commanders steadied the troops, and soon they were pushing back. The small number of Arab archers proved to be their undoing, as the Romans had the upper hand in skirmishes. Apparently, the arrows did so much damage to the forces of the Caliphate that later Arab sources called it the Day of Lost Eyes. Unable to withstand the volleys, the Arabs started to pull back. Shortly after, they were followed by the Romans. This attack had the Muslim forces on the back foot and in full flight, all of them except the leftmost unit of the center, which managed to crush the enemy detachment in front of it and attacked the right side of the Roman center. Eventually, this group was overwhelmed. The Muslim withdrawal stopped around the camps, but they were chased by the Romans. According to the Arab sources, the Muslim women joined their brethren in the fight against the attackers. It is impossible to confirm it, but it seems that by the end of the fourth day of the battle, the Romans were either pushed back or disengaged on their own. Both sides were extremely tired and battered. Some sources mention that there was an attempt to negotiate from the Romans and that the Arabs refused. But in any case, the army spent the 19th of August resting. Khalid made just one change to the formation. All of his horsemen were drawn into one large detachment behind the right-wing infantry, save for one cavalry unit, which was sent north into the desert. At the dawn of August 20th, the sixth day of the battle, both sides charged and engaged in a melee across the line. After the melee began, Khalid sent a portion of his cavalry forward with an order to attack the side of the Roman left, but upon their approach, Roman cavalry wheeled around their footmen and blocked their advance. That was the moment the Arab commander was waiting for, as the rest of his horsemen moved forth, attacking the Roman cavalry from the side and rear. Soon the Roman horsemen were crushed, and the Arabs attacked the infantry, which broke under the attack from three sides and started falling back to the center. The Muslim right now attacked the Roman center left from the flank and rear. Meanwhile, the commanders of the Roman army noticed that their left-wing cavalry was being routed from the field by the consolidated Arab cavalry, and they attempted to counter that by bringing their mounted troops together. Unfortunately for the Romans, it was too late, and before they were able to form up, Khalid smashed into them, routing them. The Roman cavalry wasn't able to resist for long, and promptly started to leave the field of battle. Back east, the Armenians were defending against attacks from two sides, and for now were able to hold off the assailants. However, after Khalid dealt with the Roman cavalry and made sure that they wouldn't return, his horsemen charged into the rear of the Armenian formation. They collapsed under the charge and started retreating to the southwest. The Arabs repositioned to attack the center right and the right of the Roman infantry, but before they did, the latter fled on their own, again to the southwest, towards the only crossing over the river. All the while, the Muslim cavalry blocked off their retreat from the north and footmen from the east. The remains of the Roman army were hoping to cross Wadi Erkad, but the 500-strong Arab-mounted unit sent away into the desert had already been commanded to block off this crossing. Understanding that they were in a trap, the Roman officers attempted to form up some kind of defensive line, but before they could do it, they were attacked by the cavalry from the north and the infantry from the east. It was a slaughter, and many thousands were killed in this encirclement, with some units managing to cross the river by swimming. Around half of the Roman army lay dead on the plain of Yarmouk, while the Muslims lost less than a fifth of troops. At this point in this story, we have to leave the Syrian front, as things have started heating up in Iraq. In the aftermath of the decisive victory at the Battle of the Bridge, Persian forces made no moves to capitalize on it, either hoping that the attack was over, or being preoccupied with other matters. This gave Caliph Umar time to come up with a response. Lacking an immediate source of manpower, the pragmatic Rashidun Caliph raised another army from the previously untapped tribes who rebelled against the Caliphate during the Ridda Wars, including the Banu Tamim and Banu Jadila. These warriors, supplemented by additional contingents mustered by Umar, were gathered and sent north, but problems were still present. Quarreling between many of the tribal chiefs prompted the Caliph to appoint a trusted paragon to supreme command, who was absolutely beyond reproach. After being talked out of leading the army himself, Umar's commander would be Sa'd bin Abi Waqqas, the seventh person to embrace Islam, and a companion of the Prophet. The presence of such a respected general united the army in spirit. Additionally, many more warriors joined themselves to Sa'd's invasion force as it marched north up the Medina Hira Road in May of 636. By the time it reached the Euphrates region for a second time, the Muslim army was probably the most formidable Persia had faced so far. Unfortunately for Sa'd, resistance to his advance was soon in coming. The best Sassanid general, Rostam, who basically ruled the court of the 12-year-old Shah Yazdegerd III, wanted to fight smaller battles to minimize risk. But that decision was unpopular with the nobles and commoners alike, as the Battle of the Bridge probably made the empire complacent. Therefore, the general departed the Persian capital at the head of a massive imperial force, beelining straight for the Muslims encamped near Qadisiyah. The two opposing armies finally caught sight of one another across the span of the Al-Attiq Canal, about 30 miles east of Hira. After an exhausting march in the midst of Iraq's blistering summer, Rostam ordered his men to take up positions and encamp across from Sa'd's army. Rather than immediately mounting an assault across the canal, the bulk of both armies remained on their own side of the waterway for several months, with the peace only punctuated by small scouting missions and raids. Rostam probably knew that the previous Islamic army had been defeated during a botched river crossing, and was therefore content to wait and receive Sa'd's attack, hoping it would happen again. The Muslims, meanwhile, were fighting a two-front war, so keeping the Mesopotamian army passive for the time being was prudent. In Syria, their army was engaged against the Romans in a campaign which culminated in mid-August at the Battle of Yarmouk. With the Christian Empire's war machine broken, Umar was free to dispatch reinforcements to Sa'd's force. In the hope of keeping Rostam occupied, the Muslim leader sent repeated embassies to treat with his Persian counterpart, demanding that the Zoroastrians submit to Islam in return for peace. With the Sassanid commander unwilling to convert, and reinforcements streaming into their camp, the Muslims challenged their enemy to battle, arraying their forces in formation and allowing the Sassanids to cross the canal, withdrawing a mile to the rear. With the Al-Attiq Canal bridge occupied by Muslim guards, Rostam's imperial army spent the night hours damming the waterway with debris to enable passage. At dawn, Rostam, seated on his throne, ordered his army across, and had the army advance in battle formation against the arrayed Muslim forces. The climactic struggle for Persia was about to begin. the army under the authority of Rostam Farrukhzad was likely made up of, at most, 60,000 Sassanid troops. Even a Sassanid field army at the absolute apex of the empire's power probably would not have been able to muster such massive numbers, and it is even more unlikely that the politically divided, militarily exhausted realm of 628 onwards could bring to bear anything more than 60,000. Rostam's bulwark was also a multi-ethnic army, having come together from regions all across the vast expanse of the territory ruled by the House of Sasan, from Azerbaijan to Khorasan. It included among its ranks Kurds, Armenians, Turks, Arabic allies, and units from many other peoples. The right and left center units of the imperial army were under the command of Jalinus and Birzan respectively, and in total comprised 30,000 warriors, 20,000 melee infantry and bowmen in the first line, and 10,000 cavalry in the second. Among these troops were 10,000 professionally trained Persian immortals, revered elite fighters who chained themselves together as a signal to the enemy that they were prepared to die rather than retreat. Bounded by swampland, which was difficult to traverse, the Sassanid left and right wings were led by Mihran and Humuzan, both illustrious generals, drawn from high-born Persian clans. Each led 10,000 infantry in their front rank, backed by 5,000 cavalry behind. In front of Rostam's line was a screen of 33 mail-clad elephants. 18 of them were deployed in the center, while the remainder were split equally on either wing. Rostam himself, donning ornate armor, mounted his raised throne just behind the center, accompanied by a small strategic reserve. About a mile to the west, Sa'd's 30,000 warriors drew up in a manner that mirrored their adversaries, four tribally organized divisions, with infantry in the first line and cavalry in the second. In addition to the Muslim forces from Arabia proper, Christian Arabs from the border of Sassanid territory, and even some captured Persian officers had joined the army after converting to Islam. Although Sa'd bin Abi Waqqas was capable of deploying his army properly, ailments and injury prevented him from mounting a horse and exercising effective tactical control. Instead, the companion general appointed a trusted deputy, Khalid bin Afuta, to carry out his immediate orders, and took up a strategic position atop the fortress of nearby Uzayb. The various units were commanded by their tribal chieftains, and included men such as Shirabil bin Simt, a veteran of the Ridda Wars and Syrian campaign, who led the Muslim left wing. As Rostam's large army continued to form up, Muslim soldiers took part in their usual noon prayer, donned their armor, and waited. By the early afternoon hours, the massive Persian army was finally ready to fight. Rostam's plan was simple and to the point: smash both flanks of the enemy army, and then smash into their exposed center. The Battle of Al-Qadisiyya began with a heavy barrage of arrows loosed by the Sassanid archers, whose superior bows and higher quality arrows inflicted massive casualties on their lightly armored counterparts. The Muslims attempted to return the favor, but their low-powered bows and inferior arrows resulted in the missiles bouncing harmlessly off the Persian heavy armor. The amused Sassanid troops mocked the Muslim archers by repeating the word, "spindles, spindles," as the impotent arrows fell harmlessly. With most of the Islamic front line pinned in place by Rostam's lethal storm of arrows, the general ordered a 7-strong elephant corps on his left to lead a charge directly at the Muslims opposing him, followed by the rest of the troops. Frightened by the oncoming Titans, the Rashidun mounts forced their riders to scatter from their position, leaving the infantry exposed. Beset by Mihran's flank and lacking cavalry support, the Muslim warriors fell back slowly, suffering casualties but not breaking under the assault. Sa'd, witnessing the danger his right flank was in from Uzayb, had two units of cavalry from the unengaged center dispatched to reinforce and shore up the line. One of these contingents struck Mihran's troops in the front, while the other hit them in the flank, pushing the Persians back to their starting position after a fierce fight. Observing that his attack on the Muslim right was stalling, Rostam completely changed tack. He dispatched part of his immediate reserve under Bahman to keep that part of the Muslim army locked in place, then ordered the Sassanid right and right center to advance, fronted by elephants and covered by another deadly volley of arrows. Again, the vanguard of elephants panicked Rashidun mounts and forced the horsemen to flee for infantry cover. This state of affairs could not continue if victory for Islam was to be attained. Sa'd, realizing he had to do something about the Sassanids' assault beasts, had orders conveyed that light troops from the Arabian Bani Tamim tribe deal with them. Darting in and amongst the massive elephants with considerable skill and daring, the agile warriors cut the cables which kept the elephants' mounting platforms atop the animals, and showered the occupants with missile fire. A vast number of the isolated elephant riders were killed where they stood, while the rest led their exhausted war mounts back behind the main Persian line. The general Sassanid attack on this side of the field was also wrestled back. In an attempt to take advantage of his enemy's lack of elephants, Sa'd ordered a general attack all across the front. It is said that while the Sassanids were equipped better than their foe, the Muslims were superior fighters. This level of skill allowed a unit in Sa'd's center to punch through the Persian line and get close to the enthroned Rostam. Descending from his position, the general drew his sword and entered the fray personally, along with some retainers. With the army's morale bolstered by the presence of their leader, the Muslim counterattack was repelled and the front re-established. By nightfall, the last of the day's fighting had come to an end. This first dreadful day, also known as the Day of Disorder by the battered Rashidun warriors, was over. The wounded were gathered and cared for by women in the Muslim camp and trained surgeons of the Sassanid army, while the remainder rested. When dawn came, both armies once again lined up for battle, facing off until mid-morning. At around noon, 1,000 reinforcements from Syria under Keka bin Amr began streaming onto the field to reinforce the Muslim army, coming 10 at a time so as to give the illusion of vast numbers. This increased the morale of the Muslim army tenfold, and Sa'd immediately ordered another charge all across the line. Despite the heavy casualties that his troops inflicted on the Sassanids, the enemy ranks remained coherent and unbroken, mainly due to the force of their heavily armored cavalry. Casualties increased as the fighting grew more and more brutal, but after 2 hours of fruitless fighting, both sides pulled back. The Muslims were trading well, 4 dead Persians for each of their own, but Rostam, trusting in his superior numbers, was content to grind Sa'd's force into the dust. On the Muslim side, Kaka, displaying his energetic and restless nature, used the break-in fighting to cover the camels that the Rashidun army brought with wooden structures, making them look to the untrained eye of a horse like unfamiliar, terrifying beasts. When fighting resumed not long after, the disguised camels were paraded in front of the charging Persian cavalry, spooking the horses into breaking ranks. Sensing an advantage, Sa'd had the army attack along the entire front again. This time, without elephants or cavalry to bolster their ranks, zealous Muslim warriors scythed into the Persians' units, viciously routing many of them towards the waterway behind and almost causing the entire Sassanid army to buckle with the shock. However, Rostam's personal intervention and unmoving confidence allowed his shattered contingents to get back into the fight. Throughout the evening hours, Persian and Rashidun troops engaged in a slogging match, which, as the sun dipped beneath the horizon, managed to painstakingly throw the Muslims into retreat. With that, both exhausted armies retired for the night. When daylight came on the third day, and the armies were arraying for battle, Sa'd's troops were met with an unwelcome surprise. The enemy ranks parted briefly, and through them marched the mighty elephants, recovered and rearmed, now each surrounded by a protective ring of infantry and cavalry. When mid-morning came, Rostam had his archers unleash another extended arrow volley, which locked the Muslims in place. As this barrage concluded, the entire Sassanid army, fronted by the terrifying elephants, began inexorably trudging onward. Suddenly, as they approached Sa'd's line, the infantry shielding each elephant's front shifted aside according to plan, enabling the giant war beasts to crash into the Muslim line at close range. The riders were able to escape and fled without delay, but the infantry weren't so lucky. Sa'd's entire army was brutally shoved back, losing hundreds of men who were gored by tusks, crushed by the elephant's feet, or put to the sword by Persian arms. Rostam caught the smell of blood in the water. In order to end the battle, he sent a cavalry division on a deep flanking attack against Uzeib Castle itself, but this was rapidly countered by a unit of Muslim riders. Although that attempt failed, the army of Islam was visibly about to disintegrate, despite the coming of even more reinforcements from the west. Taking advice from a defected Persian soldier at the last possible moment, Rashidun light infantry slid through the ranks, surrounded the two lead elephants, and blinded them, before swarming the creatures and their onboard missile troops. With the elephant alphas killed, other beasts along the line were overwhelmed and killed in the same manner. Many others, driven into a rage by pain and unable to see through mutilated eyes, turned 180 degrees and stampeded towards the canal, crashing through the Persian ranks and disordering Rostam's army. Sa'd ordered yet another full-scale assault, impacting upon the Sassanids with devastating force. Al-Qadisiyah was devolving into a war of attrition. Not even darkness on the Day of Hardship brought the fighting to an end, but the soldiers' sheer exhaustion gradually led the troops to disengage at sunrise the next day. Both armies seemed to be at breaking point, but it still wasn't clear who the victor would be. As both armies rested, Kaka decided to make a decisive move. Under the cover of a brief sandstorm, he and 700 troops launched an attack on the blinded Persian center, breaking through the line and approaching Rostam. Isolated and disoriented, the Sassanid general was found by a Rashidun soldier and slain. Fighting continued until rumors of their commander's fate spread around the Persian army. At that point, the center finally cracked and routed towards the river, followed shortly after by both flanks. The imperial army of the Sassanid Empire had been defeated. The Sassanids lost more than 20,000, while the Muslim losses were less than 10,000. Although the Muslims seemingly scored decisive victories against two of the strongest empires of the period, the war in the region was hardly over. The next episodes of this series on early Muslim expansion will take us to Egypt, Constantinople, Central Asia, Spain, and France. So make sure you are subscribed to our channel and have pressed the bell button. We would like to express our gratitude to our Patreon supporters and channel members who make the creation of our videos possible. Now you can also support us by buying our merchandise via the link in the description. This is the Kings and Generals channel, and we will catch you on the next one.